Scottish Mortgage seeks out lateral thinkers like academics, authors, and experts in the industry to shape our investment ideas. Not the usual suspects and narrow mindset of financial analysts and investment industry commentators. That way, we continue to build a portfolio that reflects real-world progress, not financial world noise. Scottish Mortgage is managed by Baillie Gifford. A key information document is available by visiting bailliegifford.com. As with any investment, capital is at risk.
Hello, my name's Jeremy Gordon and welcome to the Funds Fanatic Show. I'm very pleased to be joined on the podcast today by Dominic Scriven, a pioneering investor in Vietnam. Dominic is the founder and chairman of Dragon Capital, the oldest independent asset manager in the country. The group runs Vietnam Enterprise Investments Limited, a £1.4 billion investment trust, which pretty incredibly has been going since 1995. Dominic, good to speak to you again. Welcome to the podcast.
Hello, Jeremy. Good morning to you. Good afternoon from here. Very great pleasure to be on the show.
Yeah, I should say, thanks for making the time. I think it's 6 p.m. on a Friday in Vietnam.
Well, nothing more important than work, is that?
Well, arguably. Okay, let's get started. You moved to Vietnam in 1991. As a society, how's Vietnam changed in the 30-plus years that you've been there?
Well, that's an interesting question. I mean, it's obviously changed a great deal. I mean, if you look at numbers, the population's gone from 66 to 100 million people. Which is slightly more than a million growth in the population every year, and all of what that means to the workforce. Incomes have gone from a rather ludicrous and speculative $227 per person per year in my first year here to hopefully $4,500 per person per year this year, which means that Vietnam exits the group of low-income countries per the World Bank's definition, becomes a middle-income country, albeit at the lower level. You know, so that's great for Vietnam and its people.
Yeah.
In other ways, I mean, I'm talking to you from the 69th floor of a building in Hanoi. Nobody could see more than really two floors when we started. So it's grown in many ways, not least upwards. But, you know, In so many senses, it's still the Vietnam that people would recognize from then with strong family traditions. The interpersonal relationships here still are of enormous importance. Of course, they are everywhere, but, you know, in a rapidly evolving, society where, you know, institutions are slow to develop, interpersonal relationships have a higher priority. And I've always found that a great aspect of life here, both in the workplace, but also outside the workplace. You know, so many things haven't changed. We could talk about, changing household structures. You know, you see this a lot in East Asia, and in South Asia, of course, where you get multiple generations living together. And, you know, that's beginning to break down. And so people living in single units. But anyway, it's been a lot of change, but the key parts still remain the same. That's why I'm still here.
Okay. And what about, you know, as an investor, has it changed?
Well, if you take a snapshot, when we started investing, there was a company law in 1992, my first year here, which was 22 pages long, and it was absolutely silent on the notion of foreign investors in Vietnamese companies. And so every investment we made was an exception, and we needed to get an exception from the highest level of the executive, basically the Prime Minister's office. And there were no markets. Now, of course, you know, there are 1,500 listed companies, public companies. There's tens of billions of dollars of foreign investment, and the markets themselves are 50% of GDP, which is sort of $220 billion, and people can buy and sell. So, you know, that sort of aspect has changed a great deal, and it's brought with it a lot of the positive developments and also the challenges of becoming a modern economy. I'd stress here that, of course, you know, modern economic Vietnam is really only 30 years old. Modern Vietnam per se is 50 years old. And indeed, this year, Vietnam celebrates 50 years of diplomatic relations with Britain. So that's a cause of great celebration in our sort of bilateral life.
Yeah.
But in economic terms, it's really 30 years and all that's happened. So it's one generation. So companies, for example, are getting to the stage where, you know, succession is an issue. And so, you know, family businesses are going, well, you know, mum, dad are saying, well, kids, do you want to take it over? Or the kids often aren't interested. And so that becomes an entry point for, you know, strategic investors, and many of those are foreign. So it's quite a lively and interesting period. But a lot of the aspects we meet are happening for the first time. So there's an element of learning about something new. And that's a challenge and a reward, really. And Vietnamese don't flinch from the challenges.
Yeah. And you, I mean, so we mentioned your firm runs about $5 billion of assets. But the best known fund is this investment trust, Vietnam Enterprise Investments Limited, also known as Vail, it's London Stock Exchange ticker. Right. I mean, so how did you, a British guy, come to set that up in 1995? You know, it seems a potentially outlandish proposition.
Well, I didn't really. I was trained for a few years in investment management, and I didn't know anything else. And I'd finished my studies. I went to Hanoi University to learn Vietnamese, and I'd finished my studies and running a bit low on cash and needed a job, and there weren't a lot of jobs, and so it seemed like a, you know. It didn't seem foolhardy. It seemed like a bit of a challenge, but it seemed like a natural thing to do, try and start a fund. There were a few funds here, but we started out with the idea of, you know, engaging with Vietnamese companies. There weren't very many, and it was difficult, as I mentioned, and all of that. But you know, clearly in most countries, you want to do business with the people of that country who understand the environment and have the businesses and who can sort out the problems. And, you know, you try and provide value to them. But I do remember the, you know, there was no shares really. There's certainly no market. So I remember the first marketing trip I did was actually with a whole bunch of large laminated photographs of the businesses in which we, you know, thought we might invest.
Yeah.
You know, a honey business, a slipper manufacturer, an aircon assembler, a bank, these sort of things, and wandered around with a big laminate. You know, that wasn't quite the prospectus. That wouldn't have worked even then.
Yes.
But, you know, and then, you know, offer letters went by fax and all that sort of thing, in the middle of the night. Yes. Yeah, so it was a wonderful, it's been a wonderful journey, really. I wouldn't question really any of it. You know, there's been bad moments, challenges, but it's generally been a good journey for Vietnam, and you know, we've been with Vietnam, so it's been not a bad journey for us.
Yeah. And what do you wish you'd known when you set up the fund, or you know, has it been such a kind of unpredictable experience that question doesn't quite apply?
Well, I've never really felt that the direction of the country was in question, frankly. I mean, it's difficult for us now to cast our minds back, but in the early 90s, the framework of Asia was what you'd have 15 years of Deng Xiaoping in China. So things were really beginning to motor. They didn't actually have, you know, big open markets in China then, not until quite a lot later. But clearly you could see where China was heading. Deng Xiaoping, you know, it's not important whether the cat is black or white, so long as it catches mice, that sort of thing. To get rich is glorious. And then you had Korea and Taiwan, who just moved from sort of, you know, martial law, really, to open and democratic countries, and were opening up their economies and markets. And then you had Southeast Asia, which was really sort of doing the same. So it would have been quite bizarre for Vietnam not to follow the same sort of track, particularly given its state of impoverishment and, you know, lack of friends after, you know, in that period, the Soviet Union was really Vietnam's only friend. And of course, the Soviet Union in the early 90s was imploding. So the direction has not really ever been in doubt. The timing most certainly has been. It's been very, very difficult to predict what would happen when. And so, you know, one's had to build in a great store of resilience and patience, and also temper one's ambitions. And that's a good lesson in life, I think for everyone, but it's certainly been true. But I mean, I suppose to answer your question, you know, I thought, okay, we start Dragon and we'll sell the business in 3 years and go and lie on the beach. Nobody told me that wasn't going to happen.
Fair enough. Well, let's come on to today. So Dien Vu, the main portfolio manager of Vail, whose name I've probably just mispronounced, said in a recent update, last year's precipitous market decline largely tracked increased global risk aversion as the Federal Reserve aggressively raised interest rates. Now, you know, buried within that quote is the fact that it was a difficult year for Vietnam's stock market and for Vail last year. But as well as those global factors, there were also some very specific Vietnam issues, right? Particularly to do with corruption and financial markets. I mean, can you talk about that a bit and those challenges?
Yes, I can indeed. You know, my sort of in a nutshell, I think what happened was that from when the market started in 2000 until sort of 2010, i.e., their first 10 years. You know, the equity market and the debt market as well, but the equity market certainly were also RANDs. Nobody really paid any attention. And then in the early teens, 2012, 13, 14, the markets began to grow. And by 2019, and then particularly into 2020 and 2021 over COVID, the markets had shot and they'd become, you know, two thirds as big as the banking sector. And the lack of attention from policymakers, legislators, and regulators, and the lack of resources, frankly, you know, the market's running ahead of the capacity to regulate. Suddenly, people looked around, they went, geez, these markets are big. We need to have a real close look at what's going on. And they identified, a couple of, you know, sort of banner instances really of market abuse. I'd say in one case it was market manipulation, and in another it was misleading information in offering documents. I mean, at the end of the day, and and the regulators came down very hard, and of course the market is overly retail in its participation, and retail investors, you know, often don't have the perspective of let's say institutions. And so, you know, a lot of people were given a very severe shock. I think
so retail investors were worrying the whole thing might collapse on a house of cards. There might be widespread frauds and that kind of thing.
Well, not knowing where it would begin and where it would end. Yes, I think that's right, Jeremy. Yeah. I mean, in 2021, I don't have the numbers, 22, the total volume of the market in the year was 93% retail investor.
Okay.
So institutions play a very, very small role, obviously including us. And so it is a disproportionate size. Of course, that speaks itself to the uneven nature of market development. But I think our view on this would be, you can't have market, you know, markets where there's abuse are not properly functioning markets. So essentially what happened was right. And, I don't think this is, you know, some people have talked about some massive crackdown, all the rest of it. No, I think basically people, but you know, arguably a little belatedly, the relevant authorities are tackling things that have got out of whack. So, you know, sentiment was hit for sure. And you know, we'd need some time for that to recover. But it's essentially the right thing for the future of the markets and for the future of capitalism in Vietnam. Of course it is, yes.
Yeah. I mean, you know, these issues went very high up. I mean, so the boss of the Ho Chi Minh Stock Exchange has been dismissed for serious violations, I say in air quotes. I mean, what gives you confidence that the worst is over?
Well, that's a good question. And let's just talk. So last year, there are essentially four incidents. So the first to which you refer, Jeremy, is a clean out at the market regulator. For reasons that have been alluded to, but haven't yet been addressed in a proper judicial or regulatory,
okay.
Environment.
So it's not entirely clear yet what happened.
No. Well, I think most of us know, but the charge sheet hasn't yet been formally tabled, if you know what I mean. The second, following closely on that, was a case of manipulation of shares in one, you know, group company. And that was followed by misleading information in a bond issuer, of course, not related to the equity market, but related to retail investors. And then that was followed towards the end of the year with a sort of bank real estate group, really pulled up for the same set of issues of misleading investors. And, as we come into this year, there's been a couple of issues that have happened this year. In the early part of the year, a couple of deputy prime ministers resigned. And then, of course, most recently, the president has retired early. But those are different. Those are not related to the equity markets. Those are essentially related to issues that arose during COVID of artificially inflating the prices of COVID test kits and irregularities in arranging repatriation flights for people. And both of those two aspects, you know, those hit at the heart of the people and their experiences during COVID, which, as we know from everywhere, not least Britain, that are, you know, extremely sensitive issues. The recent people who retired and resigned, they're not charged with any direct involvement, but they are being held accountable that stuff happened on their watch. So I think if you put all of these issues together, you can pull a common theme, which is that the political structures in this country are demonstrating a very low level of tolerance for abuse of position and abuse of responsibility for both acts of commission and acts of omission. And, it's quite rigorous, but if you're a Vietnamese person on the street, you're probably behind all of this.
Okay. Mm. And I better just ask, so were you, is Dragon Capital, an investor in you mentioned one firm with a dodgy bond issue, you mentioned some banks caught up in this. Were you an investor in any of these companies?
No, thanks for asking, because I can clarify that in none of those instances were we anywhere close in any of our portfolios. Of course, that doesn't exclude the fact that, you know, issues may pop up in the future. And a lot of what we need to be, eyes out and in the back of our heads, not just to what's going on elsewhere, but what's going on between other people that might affect us. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's conceivable that there'll be aspects. In fact, I'm aware of a particular issue at the moment that might involve us, making a disclosure about an investigation going on in a company in trading in a company in which we were also a holder. But none of this is anything
can you explain that a bit more? Sorry, that's to do with market manipulation of a company which you also happen to hold.
Yeah. So I can say this, and we're live on the line. So I'm being very straight up, Jeremy. This has happened today.
Wow. Okay.
That some of our funds traded in a stock last year, and two shareholding groups battling over control of that company. One of them appears to have raised the issue that, you know, trading by various people, including ourselves, was irregular.
Oh, right.
So we haven't got, there's no investigation into Dragon, let me hasten to add, but the issue has been raised with a broker with whom we were dealing. And so we need to be, you know, on our toes in getting to the bottom of this. It's not big trading. It wasn't a big holding. It's a publicly listed bank. But it looks like we may have been a little bit of collateral between two opposing parties.
Right. Okay. What's the
I think, reference one of your earlier questions. This is the sort of stuff that can happen here. Yeah.
Mm.
I mean, I guess it can happen in other places as well, but it can certainly happen here. It's part of the, you know, rough and tumble of trying to be an investor.
Yeah. And what's the name of that bank? Are you able to say that or not?
It's, EIB is the ticker, which is Exim Bank, which is quite a big bank. There were two groups, looking to take control of the bank, and neither of them could because there was a foreign strategic shareholder, and the foreign strategic shareholder sold, I believe, to one of the groups. And, so that opened up, that made the decision in terms of who controlled the bank.
Okay. Well, it certainly sounds like one to watch there, Dominic. I suppose, you know, there'll be people who say this all sounds like very risky stuff. You know, is this all part and parcel of running a single country frontier market equity trust? You know, I suppose why do you feel that people are compensated for the risks that are clearly involved here?
That's a very good question. I mean, one of the points I'm at pain to emphasize, and my colleagues, I think, share this, is when you go to present to investors, it's very important that investors understand the nature of the investment with which they're being presented. So, for example, risk averse, or indeed investors without a time horizon, would be best advised, you know, to treat somewhere like Vietnam quite carefully.
Yeah.
But, I mentioned at the beginning, the journey's been essentially a good journey. And it has. So, I mean, we had a bad year last year, but beginning of last year, you know, Vail, was showing a 21 year return compounded net of everything of 12% a year. And, you know, that turns $1 into about $12.
Yeah.
And so over the long term, the returns are, you know, rather lower than perhaps some of the other people who've been on your show. That's a good long-term track record. And that's really what we aim to achieve. So, you know, a lot of our work, we're an active manager, of course, and a lot of our work is engaged not in looking for extra returns, but in being aware of where risks can occur and trying to, you know, manage out the risks and let the sort of growth take care of itself.
Yeah.
So of course, in an ETF, let's say, you know, a passive structure, there's no the risk is really related to the, you know, market cap weights and the tracking errors and the trading ability. It's not what I would call more qualitative type work, most particularly in governance, but also, you know, in other areas as well. So that's a, That's an absolutely key part of our DNA. I mean, I always, you know, people talk about ESG. I always say, well, you know, everybody in Dragon is a governance warrior. They have to be. They just can't be in the firm if they're not. It's the, you know, the ENS is where there's a bigger learning curve these days. But governance, you know, sits there. So to wrap up your question, maybe it would be wrong to, I think it might be the wrong way to look at Vietnam and say, I'm going to buy in January and sell in June, you know, right. because US, there's going to be a US recovery. No, it's because, you know, of long-term shifts in the global trading markets. It's because of, you know, long-term Vietnamese productivity. It's because of urbanization and industrialization and institutionalization, you know, in a soft sense. So, you know, the development of the rule of law. You know, I was at a thing at lunch today with a fellow from the National Assembly. The National Assembly is a law, the lawmaking institution. It's gone from nowhere to being, you know, one of the four key pillars of Vietnam's governance structure. It's a really wonderful thing to see. And so you could, I mean, maybe I sit here and I see it every day. So, you know, but it's a journey. It's absolutely a journey. And I think I can understand why you'd ask that question. I hope time will show that this has been putting things right rather than undermining things and making them wrong.
Yeah. Thanks, Dominic. Maybe we can ask one more big picture question before you give a bit of a flavour of what's actually in the portfolio. You mentioned shifts in kind of global trading patterns. There's been a lot of excitement about Vietnam and Vietnamese manufacturing as companies try to shift supply chains away from China. Particularly, you know, since the pandemic started, since trade tensions with the US ramped up. I mean, how is that trend going? And you know, specifically, were you disappointed by Apple's decision to ramp up iPhone production in India rather than Vietnam recently? Maybe we can start with that one, and then you can talk about how it's going generally.
Extremely distressed, Jeremy. See anyone else get any of the pie? No, and of course, what you refer to was quite well covered by The Economist, wasn't it, a couple of weeks ago with some articles on Apple. So Apple's responding to, conventional economic pressures, isn't it? But it's also a very good example of the global, the geopolitics and what's going on. And that's, yeah. That's more than my pay grade. But, you know, what one sees in Vietnam is that, if you look at the numbers, you know, Vietnam has a monstrous trade deficit with China, from whom it imports all sorts of things. And it has a stupendous trade surplus with the US, about the same size. And, clearly what's happening is that people are relocating from China, and that's allowing them to continue. So what they're doing is they're slightly adjusting their supply chains. In regards to Apple, yes, absolutely. There's been some great publicity about Apple moving to India. But, you know, Apple's also in Vietnam. Apple suppliers are 160,000 people in Vietnam. Half of Apple's, pods will be made in Vietnam this year. And
half of the AirPods is in the AirPods.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah, and of MacBooks, we recently heard that Apple expects to sell 24 million MacBooks this year, and 8 to 10 million of them will be made in Vietnam. So, you know, you'd be greedy to expect all of that yourself. But I think Vietnam's getting a reasonable share. And, of course, that's being echoed everywhere else, because foreign investors have been, that not new, they're huge. The hotel in which I'm staying at the moment is owned by a branch of the Samsung family, the biggest foreign investor in Vietnam. And they've been here, and others have been here for many, many years. The first you know, banner investor, I would think is Puyen, which is the biggest subcontractor for Nike. Nike makes more than 50% of its clothing in Vietnam now. And so, but what's happened is from the subcontractors, you're coming to the subcontractors, and then you're coming to the contractors. Right. And then slowly you're beginning to see the brands themselves set up their, you know, their regional sourcing, rather than it being in Shanghai or, you know, in Bangkok or Hong Kong, Singapore, or wherever it is. You know, they're beginning to get confidence because you can locate here, people can educate their kids here, you know, it's a safe place, you know, all of that stuff. There's availability of people. So actually the net value add of global trade per dollar of trade is accreting slowly into Vietnam rather than away. So that's a sort of predictable trend, you know, so long as Vietnam keeps its nose clean and does the right thing. It's a predictable trend and it's a welcome trend.
Okay. Thanks, Dominic. Well, let's come a bit more onto the kind of flavor of the portfolio type question. You know, you've mentioned those layers of contractors, subcontractors, sub-subcontractors. Something we've discussed before, it's quite hard to invest directly in that manufacturing growth. So, you know, what are the key drivers for Vail's portfolio as it stands today?
Yes, it's damn difficult to invest in the global manufacturing chain, as you say, Jeremy. You know, because that's private and, you know, who knows what sort of transfer pricing is going on. And so you actually want to be quite careful, I think, where you enter that supply chain. This was true in China, of course, until, you know, Chinese policymakers were, and also, of course, the domestic Chinese capacity grew to the extent that, you know, foreign brands were able to contract directly and substantially with Chinese entities. And then those Chinese entities could act, you know, could enter the markets. So we've got that same trend going on here, but the manufacturing sector is still not yet well represented in the public markets, not well at all. So I think we play that, you know, for example, if we play global trade, you know, our holdings would be industrial zones, you know, ports, shipping companies. Yeah, obviously. Logistics companies, you know, transportation, air freight's a big thing. And then we'd play, sort of more indirectly. So for example, if you have 160,000 people working indirectly for Apple, you know, they're earning incomes, they need bank accounts, they need to borrow, they might need to borrow, buy a home. They're certainly going to spend more on beer and, you know, buy smartphones and, you know, maybe go on holiday and they'll have families and they'll want to educate their families. So there's a vast array of sort of indirect plays. These we would center. And if you look at the markets, you can see it. There's sort of two core areas. One is stuff related to real assets. So that's, housing, shopping malls, apartments, infrastructure, roads, that sort of thing. And then, of course, you've got
and you've got a developer like Vinhomes in your top 10 holdings in Vail, right?
Yeah, indeed, that's the biggest developer in the country. Yeah, absolutely, the biggest developer of housing in the country. Very successful. They, you know, to give a flavour, I mean, when they, you know, when they start one of their big developments, it's got 20,000 units planned in it.
So
think what you need schools and healthcare and transportation, bus services, you know, supermarkets, convenience stores, restaurants, leisure. You need infrastructure, roads, shopping malls, you know, you need the lot. And this is happening, of course, in all three regions of the country, the north, the middle, and the south. Actually, interestingly, you know, the south has for many years been the runner and picks up a lot of the early investing in from Hong Kong and from Taiwan and the little people from, you know, the early people from Japan and from Korea. But if you look at what's going on now, it's all happening in the, well, largely, I would say, happening in the north, where you've got, of course, you know, a much simpler issue for people moving their supply chain. If you're in Guangdong province, which is that big province south of China of 100 million people, and next door to Guangdong province is northern Vietnam. And so, you know, most of the Chinese miracle was initiated in Guangdong province. That's where Deng Xiaoping visited in 1979. And so people are, you know, for them, the issue is, can I move 100 kilometers? You know, right, for people who still eat the same noodles, it's, you know, and believe in Confucius, get out of bed at the same time in the morning. It's not, you know, people sometimes ask why aren't people rushing to Bangladesh? Well, some people are moving to Bangladesh, but, you know, viewed from that lens, people don't want to go from Guangdong to Bangladesh, you know, necessarily, unless there's a good reason, there's a skill set or a cost base or an opportunity there.
Yeah. And I think maybe before I cut you off, you're about to come on and talk a bit more about financials, I think.
Ah, yes, sorry.
And how that's the other key area of growth.
So the real type things, absolutely, Jeremy, thanks. And then the financial, so, you know, real estate related and housing and urbanization related is probably a third of the market. And another third is maybe slightly less in each case is really related to financial services. So, you know, in the last 8 years, we've had, the opening of consumer finance model, you know, credit cards as a model, car financing as a model, mortgage markets picked up. And we've got, you know, people experimenting with fintech. So you've got the whole new ways of people interacting with their financial providers. So there's lots of different models going on there, and there's lots to study. Because when you look from the outside, you go, oh god, this is a, you know, where's the 4.0 and the the digital economy. And you have to actually look into the companies and see how they're using it. There's a couple of tech companies, one of which is a great long-term holding, FPT, for us, but fabulous company. But then you look at things like F&B. So F&B is viewed as sort of, conservative, and it has its place, quite highly rated, but obviously a play on the long term growth of the consumer market. And then you've got energy and materials, and that sort of, makes up the, and transportation really. That sort of makes up the market, but you've got to have a view on the real estate related and the financial sectors, because that's like over 50% of the market. And so that would be your first questions you ask yourself when you build a portfolio.
Okay. Well, thanks very much, Dominic. I think sadly, you know, we could probably speak a lot longer, but that's all we've got time for today. So yeah, just want to say, well, thanks very much for joining me on the podcast and speaking, so candidly about Dragon Capital and what you do.
Jeremy, you're very kind. It's been a great pleasure. It always is. Thank you very much. And I wish you and your listeners a very happy year of the water hare, which has just begun. Some people call it a cat and some people call it a rabbit. It is, in fact, a water hare because it's my year and I know it.
Excellent. Well, thanks again, Dominic, and a happy year of the water hare to our listeners too. And please look up for more podcasts from us soon.
Scottish Mortgage seeks out lateral thinkers like academics, authors, and experts in the industry to shape our investment ideas. Not the usual suspects and narrow mindset of financial analysts and investment industry commentators. That way, we continue to build a portfolio that reflects real-world progress, not financial world noise. Scottish Mortgage is managed by Baillie Gifford. A key information document is available by visiting baillieGifford.com. As with any investment, capital is at risk.